Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's About Time for True Crime.
Hey.
Hi. How are you?
Swell. How are you?
I'm doing great, honestly. How are you, listener? What are you doing?
Are you in the shower? Hey, girl.
Hey. We won't scare you. Don't worry.
We are sitting in my house, the pod loft, if you will. We have a vanilla candle going because
always.
That's pretty much exclusively the only kind of candle I get. I'll go to TJ Maxx and I'll smell them all. And I'm like, the one I go home with is either something that I want to eat or it's vanilla.
Yep.
And that is it.
Yeah, we differ that way. But I do always love the vanilla candles.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
And I have the Gryffindor common room fireplace on the TV behind us so that it's just really setting the mood.
Which really works because honestly, I hosted a bachelorette party this weekend.
You did?
I did. And we had a Harry Potter party.
Which is amazing.
It was so fun. The bride went as the Golden Snitch because of course.
As she should.
She is the way to win the game.
Of
you know
course.
What I mean? I went as a howler.
You did as letter?
As the letter. So I dressed up in all red and I had like a little letter handwriting scarf thing on. And then I just howled the whole time. Not like, oh, but like I just screamed the whole
Ronald
time.
Ronald Weasley.
Ronald Weasley.
Where have you been?
How dare you take that car?
Oh, Ginny dear.
Yeah,
I love
that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, honestly, people went all out. There was a Snape that carried around a photo of Lily and James, except James's face was X'd out and there was a cutout picture of Snape's face pasted on it. It was so good. There was a Hagrid and she knitted her own beard.
Yes.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. It was pretty good.
The devotion.
Truly. But anyway, we were not smart enough to put on the common room from Gryffindor as ambiance. We just put on the third movie because it is objectively the best movie.
The third and the fifth, but okay.
The fifth is good. It's just not the third.
True. And but, I think we can all agree that the sixth is the fucking worst.
Oh my God. Getting through that, you're like, okay.
Ginny, wake up.
More.
Wake up.
Okay.
Have an expression. Just Bonnie Wright, damn it. Anyway, speaking of Bonnies, we also did a, not a Friendsgiving, I wouldn't call it that, but it was like our friend's Christmas. It was just four of us.
Yeah.
We did a PowerPoint night.
So fun.
Which, if you haven't done a PowerPoint night and you're weird like us, which you probably are if you're listening to this, we just started this new trend.
May I recommend it?
Yeah, that, so there's the traditional PowerPoint night where you make PowerPoints and you present them and they can be about anything. I've done ones on animals I would cuddle if they wouldn't kill me.
Yep.
Shit that annoys me.
It's true.
All different things. My celebrity predictions. I've done it all.
You have.
However, our new installment of the PowerPoint game is that we make PowerPoints for someone else to present with no context.
None. Just photos. Guess.
So I made one for our dear friend who had to present it on the spot, and it was just called my favorite things, and she had to talk about why she loved all of these things, and I put the most random ass shit on there.
Random, terrible cat litter cake shit all over.
Yes. And I had like four different hidden pictures of Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And then on the last one, she thought it was the end, and then she tapped again and it was a really big Danny DeVito.
I love it.
So we just have fun, you guys.
I did a Spotify Wrapped of my 2024 crises and made them guess what the crisis was based off the photo.
And I'd
really
say we killed it.
You
personally.
Really did. You really did. So it was a good time. It was really fun. I think you should try PowerPoints that you have to present that you did not create. It's a really great time.
It's so easy because the point for me was just like, how can I make her feel like uncomfortable? It was like, how can I make her like viscerally like, what do I say about
how do
this?
How do I present loving this?
How do I loop this in? Like I posted
and she
one.
Did so good.
She did great. But I had one of a guy wearing socks and sandals and the socks had like toes. It was the most like uncomfortable looking thing. And I was like, go ahead, tell us how you love that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Say more on that. If you're going to do your own PowerPoint night, my recommendations are that you have the following.
Mm-hmm.
A TV.
Yes.
HDMI cord.
Correct.
Laptop.
Yep.
Google.
Usually.
You're going to want to probably make it on Google Slides so you can just share it and easily present it.
Yep.
You will want a bottle of wine or two.
Certainly if you partake.
And you want cheese and crackers, chips and dip, and yummy stuff. And you have to be wearing your pajamas.
And dare I say, it's better on a Friday when the week has been so long that you are just slap happy to be done.
Correct.
Yeah. And that is a great night. For extra credit, throw a candle in there.
Of course, as you should. As you should.
And some blankies, you know?
Of course. We had all the blankies.
Oh, it's so good. You guys, just a reminder, it's 2025. There are no rules. Do what you want. Be with your friends. Be with the people that you like.
Be with the people that do not drain you, those that fill your cup and not empty it.
Yep.
That is what we are going into 2025 with here at ATFTC. We encourage you to do the same. You are in our family. So, of course, we want all of those good, good things for you.
We need both the do no harm and the take no shit.
Amen.
Yes.
And also with you.
And with you as well.
Thank you.
So, that being said, I hear that you have a case for us today.
Oh, you heard correct.
I did. And I feel like someone's going to do some harm.
Oh, they will. We're going to get into all of it. But I do think you have a thing to say.
Yoo-hoo! Pod's on.
We're going to make that mug. We promise. Hi, hello, and welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast. Aww. About time for true crime. Thank you for joining our little corner of the true crime world, where we are learning and growing and changing our minds and your minds, and being part of these important conversations means the world to us, and we welcome you with open arms and little nose boops.
Boop, boop, boop.
If you like today's episode and or like what you've heard before, we think, we're biased, but we do think you should rate the podcast 5 stars anywhere you can, tell a friend, repost and tag us, and of course, download. That is a
please
free 99 way you can tell us that you want us to keep doing this. To start us off, I just want to highlight some of the sources I used for this episode. I used IndyStar, an Indiana-based paper, Case Text, Murderpedia, an episode of Evil Lives Here, Season 3, Episode 6, and a Forensic Files episode called Blanket of Evidence, and more, which are always linked in the show notes. You can always find the sources that we use. Our trigger warnings today include domestic violence, sexual assault, and murder. Please listen with care.
Please.
Today's case is going to take us on a ride. Okay. And we're going to talk about sort of two halves of this case, and we're going to talk about how they overlap.
Ooh.
So we're going to actually start in a different place than you might think.
Okay.
Which is a whole lot of explanation where you're just going to get it anyway.
Yay.
Our case today begins with a woman named Melissa Holland. And we're talking about her in the 1980s in a small town in Indiana. Melissa grew up in a decent home where she knew she was loved, but she was rarely told that.
Mm-hmm.
And in school, she was the victim of severe bullying.
Mm.
She didn't really feel like anybody had her back. She didn't have a ton of friends. She was very shy. She had very poor self-esteem. Always felt like she wasn't good enough, that she wasn't thin enough, wasn't pretty enough. And bullies, they pick up on that. They feed off your insecurities and they use it against you. And that is exactly what happened to Melissa.
That they do.
Melissa sought comfort and protection in the arms of another teenager, one who others knew not to mess with, and she kind of felt safe in that way.
Mm.
His name was Michael Dean Overstreet, but he went by Dean. Melissa built up the courage to ask Dean out, which I give her props. She was like,
"Yeah.
Not only do I think you're cute and I kind of like you, but I also know that if people see me with you, they might leave me alone."
Yep.
So she asked him out in part because of the protection that he could offer her, but also because she was into him and she started to kind of feel safe with him.
Yeah.
At first, things were great.
Always.
Of course, they were. First of all, they were in high school. But more importantly, abusive relationships always start great because if they didn't start great, then they wouldn't have started.
Yeah, there'd be no relationship to develop to turn abusive.
As is typical, there was a gradual escalation of this behavior. It started with Dean telling Melissa what to wear, not allowing her to wear anything he believed was either revealing or drew attention to her in any way. Melissa was resigned to wearing only jeans and t-shirts.
Wow.
It escalated further when Dean had other classmates spy on Melissa in class.
Ugh.
If she spoke up to anyone, it was reported back to him. If a male student spoke to her, there was hell to pay. So if she had conversations with anybody in her class, or in the hallway, or at her locker, or anything, it seemed like he had these like little minions around that would let him know what happened.
Ugh.
Melissa was essentially surrounded, because even when she wasn't around Dean, she was.
Yeah.
Melissa didn't intend to do anything wrong or behave unfaithfully. She just seemed to always be under suspicion by Dean, and that was an uneasy feeling.
Of course.
One day, one of Melissa's classmates was selling posters for his band, and to support him, Melissa bought one.
Hmm.
Seems innocent enough. Dean found out about it, and the next day brought a gun to school and showed it to Melissa.
What?
Stating he was going to take care of the poster problem. Melissa was terrified. She didn't want anyone to get hurt, and she didn't know what to do. So she went to a trusted teacher, her math teacher, and told that teacher that Dean brought a gun to school. Before the end of the day, Dean was arrested.
Yeah.
His parents were called, and he was released to them within the day, and he received probation for this incident.
Uh-huh.
Dean knew it was Melissa that reported him, and he was not pleased.
Yeah.
He manipulated her, saying, how could you think I would even do that? I would never do that. How could you think so little of me? Did you really think I would do anything at all?
Brother, why did you bring a gun to school?
How could you betray me like this?
Ugh.
Which I'm sure made Melissa doubt herself and her instincts, because she knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
But he kind of gaslit her into making her second guess herself and to think, oh, well, was it a joke? I mean, was it loaded? Was it real? Was it? I don't know. So she just started to not trust her own instincts.
Yeah.
After graduation, the high school sweethearts got married. Melissa dreamed of having children and being a housewife, and Dean wanted this too. Dean would be the provider, except he actually struggled to provide.
Oh.
He was often between jobs, working odd ones, and quote-unquote job hunting a lot.
Got it.
He'd be gone all day, but Melissa would never really know what he was doing or where he'd been.
Yeah.
And I want to specify here that so much of what we know about this dynamic is from that episode of Evil Lives Here, and it's from Melissa in her own words reflecting on this relationship after the fact.
Yeah.
After everything. So I'm not saying that I don't think that she's an accurate historian, but I'm saying that we have to rely very heavily on one person's input, and I'm always wary to trust that
right
fully. But I don't have a reason to believe that Melissa would be dishonest here.
Yeah.
Especially because she doesn't always shed herself in the most flattering light, that I don't think it's in an attempt to do that.
Right.
One time, Melissa and Dean got into an argument that resulted in Dean pushing Melissa against a wall and holding a knife to her throat. As she tried to push the blade away, her finger was sliced open, and only then did Dean seem to show any remorse or even apologize.
Wow.
Melissa remembered that Dean was a weapons fanatic, especially knives. He always had that shit on him. He put that shit on everything.
Okay, Franks.
He would sharpen his blades almost daily and would arrange them on a table and photograph them, like, in an artistic way, almost.
Huh?
Very odd, but I don't know if you want to call it designed. I don't really know how many different things you can do with those, but he loved them. He loved that shit. He did.
Oh, me, oh my. What an artist.
Melissa did not trust her gut and continued this relationship.
Oh, Melissa.
In fact, she had children with him. And depending on reports, it's either 4 to 5 children, actually.
Wow.
And from the limited details I could find, he seemed to be an okay dad. I don't think he was winning any Dad of the Year awards, and I doubt the kids pooled their money to get him a mug that said that.
Yeah.
But there are no reports I found citing overt abuse. But I won't say that there wasn't emotional or mental abuse either, even if it wasn't his intent. Let me explain. Melissa noticed that Dean really struggled with paranoia.
Okay.
In fact, according to some reports, Dean had joined the military. I believe it was the Navy.
Okay.
But he was discharged almost immediately for psychiatric reasons.
Wow.
And typically how that presented with him was really extreme paranoia that could result in violence.
Okay.
But Dean's paranoia now far surpassed his jealousy and defensiveness over her. He wasn't just controlling what she could wear and who she could talk to. he started bringing this behavior into the family unit as a whole. Ugh. Sometimes he would get home after a long day of being away. I won't say at work. I'll say away. And would demand that all the shades be drawn and the lights be turned off because they were in danger. He told Melissa to gather the kids in an upstairs bedroom and stay close to the ground.
Oh my gosh.
Which is terrifying for those children. So while not physical abuse, and again, I don't think that Dean was like, I want to torment my children, but the children still paid the price for their dad's paranoia. And they would become victims of his behavior in other ways too.
Well, and if he in any way is abusing Melissa in the way that we've already talked about in front of them, that in and of itself is toxic and trauma. You know, like that's its own kind of abuse.
Exactly. This went on far too long, and Melissa grew increasingly scared and anxious, but also sick and tired of feeling sick and tired. Melissa had enough when Dean came home in one of his moods and demanded again that the shades be drawn and that they lay low. Melissa pushed back and said that she wasn't going to do that time, and this time he pointed a gun at her.
Oh my gosh.
She was done. She packed the kids up and she went to her mother's house and she filed for divorce the very next day.
Good.
But it was so much more complicated than she imagined. She didn't want Dean to have unsupervised visits with the children because she didn't trust him.
Right.
But she didn't have a legal leg to stand on. It was the 90s by now. She was a stay-at-home mom who had no work history and no income and had never reported his abuse before. So he had a seemingly clean record and no history of abuse except for the high school incident, which could have stayed sealed in a juvenile record for all we know.
Right.
So she's wants to divorce him and she's trying to demand that he only have supervised visits and that she have primary custody. And they're like, you can't provide for these kids.
Right.
You've shown no way that you're able to do that. And also, there's no reason that we can find that he is not a fit parent to do that.
Exactly.
And while it would be difficult, I can imagine in a plethora of ways and for many reasons, I would say now would have been the time to start reporting it.
Yeah.
Even though this would have been, again, challenging, and there's so many reasons why people don't, and I'm not oblivious to all of those, trust me.
Yeah.
But she never did go to the police. She never filed complaints or even really told anyone what was going on. So it kind of made it really difficult to have this leg to stand on. And I know that you listening have listened to ATFTC long enough to know that we don't blame victims and we understand the complexities and the layers of trauma, abuse, and violence and manipulation. But I do want to advocate that if you or someone you love is in danger, there are resources and programs and help out there for you.
Absolutely. And just on my tiny, teeny little soapbox, if somebody is consistently showing a pattern of maltreatment or abuse to you or someone that you love, even if you're not reporting it every time, which I am always an advocate for reporting it as much as possible when you can be safe doing so, write it down.
Mm-hmm.
Keep any texts you have. You screenshot that shit. You keep it in a folder called receipt on your Google Drive. And that way, in the event that something god awful happens, you can say, I didn't feel safe reporting it because of XYZ, but I have this entire history laid out for you.
Right.
And I hate that we live in a world where we have to provide proof of the things that people have done wrong to us for someone else to believe that in a lot of ways. But if we do, then the best we can do is try to prepare for it now.
In Melissa's case, she was essentially told the best she could hope for was joint custody.
Ugh.
There was no history of him abusing the children ever, and he was the provider. So even if she could point to evidence that he was abusing her, it seemed like it was still going to be an uphill battle to prove, oh, he's a risk to them too.
Right.
So she was terrified that if she went through with the divorce as it stood then, they would have equal custody and she couldn't fathom leaving her kids alone with him.
Yeah.
The only way she knew to stop that from happening was to stay with him, retract the filing for the divorce, and see if she could reconcile. And she did. And they did. And they were back together. We're going to fast forward to the early hours of September 27th, 1997.
Okay.
Melissa awoke to Dean's brother, Scott, knocking on her door. He seemed emotional and stressed out and came with a message that Dean had sent him to tell her to pick him up at a shooting range in a couple of hours.
Okay.
So Scott shows up, says Dean needs you to pick him up at the shooting range.
In a couple of hours.
In a bit. Melissa didn't know what this was about and Scott wouldn't say, but she did it because she was afraid of what might happen if she didn't pick him up and Dean made his way home, what hell there would be to pay once he got there.
Right.
So let's put a pin there.
Okay.
The night before, September 26th, 1997, 18-year-old Kelly Nicole Eckert was working at the Walmart in Franklin, Indiana.
Okay.
Kelly had recently graduated from high school where she was a part of the National Honor Society and Color Guard.
Aww.
Kelly was an excellent student and earned an academic scholarship to go to college. She loved school and loved learning, and she was working at Walmart part-time while she was in school.
Okay, queen.
On the evening of September 26th, she was finishing her shift and was out of work at 10 p.m. Her boyfriend, Anthony, and his mom had came by the store. I guess she was out of work at 10 and the three of them just shopped around Walmart till about 11:15. At that time, when they were done, they each got in their separate cars and Kelly headed home because it was late.
Yeah.
But she never made it home. And her boyfriend, Anthony Evans, never saw her alive again.
Oh my gosh.
Around midnight, Kelly's car was found on the side of the road, lights on, keys and her wallet on the front seat. No sign of Kelly.
Haunting.
There was some damage to the rear end of her car that her mom knew wasn't there before.
Okay.
But she was just missing. Loved ones held a candlelight vigil and offered comfort to each other as they hoped and waited for Kelly to be safely returned, but that didn't happen either. 4 days later, in a neighboring county about 40 miles away, Kelly's body was found in a ravine. She had been dumped. Her overalls were around her ankles. She had on her bra and underwear. Her sneakers were missing.
Oh.
She had been strangled with a shoelace and part of her overalls and had a gunshot wound to the head.
Oh my gosh.
Kelly had been raped, and her cause of death was strangulation. Many of her belongings were missing, but they did find something that they hoped would help lead to the killer. And those were green carpet fibers on her overalls.
Okay. And this is the 90s?
This is the 90s.
So we're no longer in the 70s where everybody's fucking carpet was green.
Correct.
Okay.
And this is car carpet, actually.
Oh.
So I don't know.
Even 90s. More unique.
Well, I don't know. It's still the 90s. But they did use this to try to determine what her last moves were, and they believed that she had been in a vehicle that had green carpeting and those fibers rubbed off onto her clothing. Right. And her vehicle did not have green fibers.
Got it.
Other than that, they didn't have much else.
Wow.
Police turned to the public for help, and they got hundreds of tips, but unfortunately many of them were dead ends, as you'd expect.
Right.
Connie, Kelly's mom, knew the white tennis shoes Kelly was wearing the day she disappeared, and a photo of the exact same kind of shoe was distributed to the public.
Okay.
Remember, her shoes were missing.
Right.
Her mom knew if her body was found and those shoes weren't there, you need to look for the shoes.
Right.
So they found some at the store that were the same size. I think she was a size 7.5. And they distributed a photo of that to the public and said, if you see these shoes, this is what we're looking for. This is what she had on. This is the part of her clothing that's missing.
And you said she was strangled with a shoelace?
Yes.
Do we know if it was hers?
We're going to get there.
Ooh, okay.
Finally, a break. Mm-hmm. A tip was called in that a pair of white tennis shoes were found in the restroom of the Atterbury Preserve, which was like a forest animal preserve. When investigators saw the shoes, they found that one of the shoes was missing its laces, and they confirmed those were Kelly's.
Okay.
So you were right.
Got it.
A week later, the body of 26-year-old Sharon Myers was found in that same forest preserve.
Oh my gosh.
Investigators were worried that they had a serial offender in their midst, as Sharon and Kelly were of similar age. Both died by strangulation and were found within 20 miles of each other.
Yeah,
I mean, we're talking
too.
A big area. This isn't just like your average park that this was found. This is huge. Further investigation into Sharon's murder revealed that her colleague, Jason Hubble, was responsible for her murder and that the cases were proven unrelated.
Ugh.
But there was a brief moment in time where investigators thought, how did a week go by? We found one body and now two bodies, and these girls don't not look alike.
Right.
Are similar ages, died the same way, and were dumped in the same spot.
Yeah, that's a lot of overlap.
So while they determined that Jason was responsible for Sharon's murder, he was proven not to have anything to do with Kelly's. He did not kill Kelly.
And I'm glad that they were able to get closure for Sharon's too. That sounds like it was really fast work.
But very important, I think, to mention, I know it's not super related to Kelly's case, but that all of these other things go on and
yeah,
like they're ongoing. A lot of these things are simultaneous. And so you have to try to figure out, are these things related or not?
Yeah.
And can clues from one, like you can get tunnel vision if you're looking to link them.
Mm-hmm.
You might have just pinned that on Jason.
Right.
And then her killer would still be out there. But at this point in time, they just knew they still needed to look for him.
Which is better than throwing in the towel because you think you're done.
Exactly.
Oh.
So we're going to take out the pin from before.
Okay.
Remember, we left with Scott Overstreet telling Melissa that she needed to go pick up her husband, Dean.
Right.
And she did. But weeks passed, and Scott Overstreet couldn't fight it anymore. He had to come forward with what he knew.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Scott.
He said that the night of Kelly's murder, he got a call from his brother, Dean, that he and his girlfriend were at a motel and both had been drinking and needed a ride. Girlfriend.
Yeah, I caught that. Scott. Sorry. Y'all can't see my stink eye. What the hell?
Scott drove to the motel, left his car, and got in Dean's van to drive them, as Dean had requested, strangely. He said that Dean had changed his mind, though, and that he wanted to be dropped off at a nearby park or camp called Camp Atterbury.
Hmm.
Scott claims to have covered his eyes as Dean got out of the car with a girl. This girl had before been unconscious. I don't know if she was awake at this time.
Oh.
But very odd, and Scott claimed that he didn't want to see it, so he covered his eyes.
Okay.
Scott claimed to have told Dean not to hurt her, and Dean said not to worry. He was going to get her lost in the woods.
Huh?
I don't know if that was a way of saying, oh, I'm going to kill her anyway, or if saying she's nearly passed out or she is passed out. I'm going to leave her somewhere. She's going to wake up and find her way back, but she won't remember anything. I don't know exactly what he meant here, but this is according to Scott.
Right.
Dean then told Scott to pick him up in a little bit, and Scott said no. Dean said, well, if you won't, then tell Melissa she needs to come get me at the shooting range in 2 hours. And that's what he did. He drove Dean's van to his house and got Melissa. Melissa drove herself and Scott to the motel so Scott could get his car, and then from there she went to go pick up Dean.
Wow.
When Melissa was interviewed, she let it all out.
Good.
She told police of the abuse, of the years of strange behavior, and most recently, what happened that night. She said she picked him up from the range and he had a rifle with him. He didn't say a word, just wanted to be brought home. She couldn't get anything out of him. She tried, but he wouldn't respond. She saw shell casings and a taser in the van that she'd never seen before and just apparently didn't say anything to anybody about it.
Yeah.
She also said that all of a sudden he wanted to clean the van and that it was kind of a crappy piece of shit van and was not worth cleaning, or at least she didn't seem to think there was a reason to try to make it look nice.
Yeah.
And weirder still, that he'd never cleaned it before, and more than that was that he only wanted to clean the back of the van. He didn't try to clean the dash or the front seats or anything. He was,
are you kidding,
oddly very focused.
What an idiot.
So he left the rest of it a mess, but he thoroughly cleaned the back. By now, news of Kelly's disappearance and then her murder was all over the news.
Right.
And she asked if he had anything to do with it. And he became offended. How could you ask me that? How could you think I could do anything like that? And so she shut up.
Honestly, and this isn't a good thing, but sometimes people are so good and so on top of their gaslighting that I'm kind of impressed. It's like, hey, you know how I had a girl that I might have hurt that I carried in the van that I then cleaned really meticulously with the taser and the gun casings in there, and how I've like hurt you before, and how I've brought guns in places and threatened to hurt other people before. How could you ever suggest that me, that I might hurt someone?
Don't you know me? Come by on. Now? You're supposed to be the one that knows me better than everybody. I thought I could trust you.
Yeah. Are you kidding? Gaslight too close to the sun, my man.
Like,
oh,
I'd
my
be
God.
Squinting so hard at that gaslighting.
I'd get an eye twitch.
Like,
I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Seriously. So he's just a piece of fucking shit. But anyway, between what Scott said and what Melissa said, they had enough to look more carefully into Dean.
Well, that's good.
And that investigation led straight to him. They found all the evidence that they needed. In fact, Scott took officers to where he dropped Dean off.
Nice.
So he dropped Dean off at the camp.
Yeah.
Which is where her shoes were found. Not okay. Where her body was found, where her shoes were found.
Got it. Oh, ew.
So when they had originally found the shoes, they looked everywhere. Like, right. All over this land. And they didn't find anything. But it's so big.
Right.
And they thought, well, all right, the shoes are here, but her body was found in another county down a ravine.
Yeah.
But so what else is at this place? And they thought it was just the shoes. Well, it turns out when Scott brought them to where he dropped them off, they found other things.
Oh.
Like her jewelry. I think there was an anklet. There was some other jewelry. Her pager. Some other of her belongings that were positively, absolutely hers.
Yeah.
So that links Dean to the spot where her shoes were found. And her right. Shoes weren't found far. I mean, it was all in this like, preserve.
Right.
So that was very helpful. Then, on and inside Kelly's body, they found DNA.
Ugh.
But this DNA matched Dean's. Green fibers on Kelly's overalls that we talked about, those fibers were consistent with the fibers from inside Dean's van.
Mm.
So the inside of that van was the green carpeting that we talked about.
Yeah.
There was damage to the front of Dean's van, which was consistent with the damage found to the rear bumper of Kelly's car.
Mm-hmm.
The belief here is that Dean purposefully rear-ended Kelly on a country road with no other cars around.
Yep.
And when Kelly pulled over and got out to look at the damage or exchange information or whatever, he overpowered her. And he either threatened her with a weapon and took her then, or actually did use the weapon on her. She did have a gunshot wound to her forehead.
Yeah.
But there was something unique about the bullet that it was like it had been packed with like wax or plastic or something like that. So it was like almost like a hollow point.
Okay.
So it wasn't what killed her, but it could have been what like stunned her or incapacitated her in some way. So the belief there is that either the threat of violence or actual violence is what got her into his car.
Yeah.
So when they considered that Scott could lead them to where her belongings were.
Yeah.
That it was her shoes that were left there and the lace had been used to kill her. That his semen was found in her.
Oh.
That the fibers from his van were found on her clothing.
That's enough for me.
There's a lot there.
There's a lot there.
And with this, 30-year-old Michael Dean Overstreet was arrested for the abduction, kidnapping, rape, and murder of 18-year-old Kelly Nicole Eckhart.
Oh.
His trial took place April 24th, 2000 to May 18th, 2000, nearly a month.
Wow, that's a long trial.
He was convicted on all counts.
Good.
He refused a plea deal because he said he didn't remember committing the crime and wouldn't admit to what he didn't remember.
Are you kidding?
There's a part of this that could be true. With all of what he was struggling with in terms of his mental health, I don't doubt it that it could be true. I'm not saying that it is true. I'm saying I don't think absolutely that he's lying. And I never really could find an official diagnosis because this would have all been in like the 90s and 2000s when you couldn't get that. And I don't even know if those would still be the words we'd use today.
Likely not, yeah. But how I don't know. I think just how frustrating. If you have mental health, of course that's not your fault, but you're the only one who can do anything about it. And also, if you have it, you probably know most of the things you struggle with. So if you know you struggle with violence, if you struggle with readouts where you can't remember what you do when you become enraged in a fit, I would suggest maybe taking some time to self-reflect or introspect and say, maybe I'm not the most reliable narrator here, and I can listen to the evidence that these people have.
That's assuming he has the capacity to do so.
Mm.
Because he actually was sentenced to death.
Wow.
But it has since been put on hold because he's been deemed too mentally ill to be put to death.
Okay.
Which, on one hand, the case that comes to mind is Eileen Wuornos, where
right.
she was so incredibly mentally ill. And you can look at the video footage of her within days before she was put to death. And that woman was so unwell that the thought that they put her to death was kind of shocking.
Yeah.
Because you're not supposed to do that.
True.
You're just not supposed to do that. Not when somebody is incompetent.
Right.
Then that's not... those aren't the circumstances where the death penalty comes in. But it also really frustrated Kelly's parents because now they have to keep going to court every few years and they have to keep fighting
right.
for this thing that they were already told was going to happen. So it's been put on hold. To my knowledge, it's still on hold. He battles delusions and hearing voices and seeing shadow people. He spends 20 hours a day in a cell to himself, and that seems to be his own form of hell. Kelly's mother can take comfort in that maybe he's in more pain alive now than he would be if he'd been put to death years ago.
Yeah.
The lead prosecutor in this case said of Dean Overstreet, "I think he's a guy who was probably on his way to being a serial killer, but just happened to get caught the first time."
Yeah.
He was just one evil dude.
Yeah.
And I can hang my hat on that. I think that that's a fair statement. I don't know that this was his first. I believe it was his last.
Yes. I would be hard-pressed to see somebody start with something like this.
We're going to talk about Melissa again in a second, but I want to really highlight Kelly's memory.
Yeah.
And what Kelly's family has done. Kelly's memory lives on. A beautiful tree was planted at Franklin College where Kelly was going to school.
Mm.
Again, she loved it there. She couldn't wait for her classes. It blooms beautifully every spring.
Yeah.
There was a scholarship in Kelly's name as well. Her missing photo was kept up on the walls of the Walmart she worked at. Because all the locals know her case, when they stop to look at it, they in turn notice all of the other missing photos of children and young adults who have gone missing. And they believe that it's a way that Kelly can assist in justice for others like her.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Perhaps the biggest contribution has been made by Kelly's mom, Connie Sutton. Connie is an incredible woman who has never lost momentum in her fight. She fought to pass Kelly's law in Indiana, which allows for family members to make victim impact statements to the convicted, which she and her family didn't get to do at the time of Dean Overstreet's trial. They didn't get to stand before him in court and tell him what he did, what he took from them, and how it impacts them every day. Because of this, she earned an honorary law degree from Franklin College, the same college Kelly went to. And when she wore that cap and gown at graduation, she did it for Kelly.
Yeah.
Connie's mission is to keep Kelly's memory alive and to ensure that this doesn't happen to anybody else. On this podcast, Abby and I feel so very strongly about providing any information we can think of to take what has already happened and analyze ways we might be able to prevent it in the future, taking anything we can learn. It should have never happened in the first place, but in the wake of the aftermath, what can we learn? How can we protect each other? What can we do? We want to foster those kind of discussions here in our safe corner of the true crime space. We want to encourage you to have these conversations with the people you love. Use the buddy system, watch your friends drinks, travel in pairs at a minimum, have a plan before you leave, and trust your gut are among a few of our favorites.
Yes, you'll hear them over and over and over again.
Connie volunteers with the local color guard, the one that Kelly had been part of, and she stays until every girl is picked up. Good. Because she never wants to leave any of them alone. She said, quote, "People have to remember what happened to her so it doesn't happen to them. Hopefully it reminds people to be careful that not everybody out there is good. If you're out in the middle of nowhere and it's all dark and somebody tries to stop you, I don't care if he has a flashing light. Put your flashers on to acknowledge that you see him and go to a place where you feel safe.
Yeah.
And I wanted to include that quote from her because I agree with that.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say as well, like, if it's somebody who is a police officer, someone who has the authority to pull you over, you can always drive to a police station, like, have it, you know, make them know that that's what's happening and continue on there. If it's not somebody who has that authority, they generally will kind of get the hint once you pull in and they'll be like, oh shit, maybe I don't want to be here. But if it's something like this where it's a hit and run or somebody is hitting your car and attempts to make you pull over, I always recommend at any given point in time, if you are being pulled over by anyone, to make sure somebody else knows where you are. I know this was the 90s, so this wasn't as widely accessible, but for us today, like, we have phones. Call someone, share your location. And also, if you can, take down a license plate number and then call it into your insurance yourself later when it's daytime.
There are other things that we can do now that wasn't available to Kelly at the time.
Of course.
But I also think that Kelly's case, in the spirit of trying to take something from it that I'd hope that she would want taken from it, is to just try to learn from these things. What can we do? How can we better protect ourselves?
Yeah, and it's obviously not her fault that any of this happened. And she did exactly what a normal person would do in that scenario, I think. You know, you're at work, you go home, somebody hits you, you pull over, figure it out. It was not her fault that who she ran into was so unwell and full of malice.
No, and there's no reason to believe that she would have recognized him or picked up anything, because it's said that he shopped at that Walmart occasionally, but it's believed that that night he waited for her to get out of work. Like, she was chosen ahead of time. And that he intentionally hit her car to intentionally abduct her and did it in a place where no one would notice. Right. And by the time her car was discovered, she may have already been dead.
Right.
And there would have been no way for anybody to know where she was brought.
Right.
Connie has Kelly's recovered belongings. Her mother keeps them close. She likes to keep them close.
Yeah.
Including her glasses, her car keys, and an anklet. Mm. She also keeps a ribbon from Kelly's graduation cap with her.
Mm.
She wears Kelly's ring that has her birthstone in it. She says it's hard to touch these things sometimes because the last time Kelly did, she wasn't breathing.
Wow.
As for Melissa, her children petitioned to change their last name to her maiden name immediately.
Wow.
They didn't want to be Overstreet anymore. They were bullied in school, not unlike Melissa was this time, because their dad was an infamous murderer in small town Indiana.
That's so hard.
Melissa struggled for years. She was looked at by neighbors and others in the community as equally responsible for Dean's actions because she didn't stop him. She can't go to that Walmart anymore because Kelly worked there. Her health has suffered significantly. It didn't seem like she goes out much anymore. Melissa has been essentially destroyed by Dean and what he did. And Melissa thinks of Kelly often. She thinks of the things Kelly never got to do, like graduate college, get married, maybe have a family of her own. Yeah. She becomes very emotional when she talks about Kelly. And I think there's so much to unpack with Melissa here, because had she done something beforehand, I don't know that it would have changed anything.
Right.
In terms of reporting the abuse. But she needed to want to report the abuse for her and her kids before she could want to report the abuse for some potential, maybe stranger victim.
Right.
And while what happened that night when she went to get him, If I pass judgment on anything, and I don't like to pass judgment on things I can't understand that I haven't lived, but if her gut told her he had something to do with Kelly's disappearance, that is when I would have hoped.
Yeah.
That something might have been done. But she had been manipulated for a decade, if not longer, with five kids by this man, to believe him when he said he didn't do it, even if she kind of thought he might have. She didn't have any concrete way to prove it. It just looked really suspicious. And it's not like, you know, the green fibers were shared with the public where she could have been like, well, that's a lot.
Right.
He just wanted to clean the van and wouldn't answer questions and I guess wanted to get picked up in the middle of the night, but not right where her body was found. Her body was found in a ravine, you know, 20 miles away.
Right. He was at a shooting range. I feel for Melissa in so many ways. You know, I think like we talked about, nobody gets into an abusive relationship because it's abusive the second you start. If somebody's hitting you and calling you names and controlling you when you first start talking, then you're not going to keep talking to them. That's not how that works. And I know this is a really great example of hurt people hurt people, and we all have our own damage, but we're the only people that can work on healing that so we don't hurt more people.
Mm-hmm.
With Melissa, I think about the abusive relationship and the power and control that she was experiencing before her brain was even developed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this started in high school, your brain isn't done till 25. That's so many of your formative decision-making years. Not like, you know, when you're a kid and you're learning how to say words or you're at home and you're seeing these dynamics play out. This is like the time where you're learning how to make choices and how to go through that logic process so that you know how to get from point A to point B. And if he was a part of all of that, her brain is going to learn that that's part of how you make that choice.
And that he was part of that comfort because he
right.
served as a protector beforehand.
Right.
And she felt safe with him and she felt loved and she probably felt unlovable and all of those other things that no one else would feel this way.
Right.
And then he ended up being the one that she needed protection from, and there was no protection for her at that time. So I feel for her.
Right.
In that, and I don't want to pass judgment. I think a lot of people are really hard on Melissa and saying, well, you know, you're equally responsible. You shoulder that responsibility too. And I don't think anybody's responsible for someone else's actions.
No.
But I will say that from September 27th, when she had to pick him up, and I think early November when he was arrested, if wow. he had hurt anybody in that time, I think I'd be having a different conversation.
Yes.
With Scott and with her, because if the two of you put your heads together, you could have figured it all out.
Certainly. And I think also that it's important to remember that she did reach out at one point, and what was offered to her was next to nothing. And she had to sort of figure out how to face that mess alone again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying that what she did was right, or that what she did or didn't do, you know, made a big difference. I agree with you. If somebody else had gotten hurt in this, it would be a very different conversation. But she didn't put a gun to his head and make him hurt her.
No, and I think he was hell-bent on making sure that she wouldn't know things he didn't want her to know.
Right.
So I also want to point out, to go back to Connie about yes. Kelly, because Melissa thinks so much about what Kelly could have become.
Oh.
Because Melissa, I think, blames herself in so many more ways than the community could have.
Oh, certainly.
And she feels so many things that I don't think there's anything that could be said to her or thought about her that she hasn't already said to herself.
Right.
Which is awful in its own way. But there was something that I read that Connie said. Actually, I think it was in the forensic files. And I'm talking original forensic files, yeah. like that old, you way know, back. That guy's voice.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was a long time ago and it was fresher than maybe, you know, it is now. And maybe she'd respond differently. But I got so emotional watching her talk about Kelly saying, you know, she didn't get to graduate. She deserved that. She didn't get to get married. She deserved that. She didn't get to have kids. Like, she didn't get to experience all of these things. And she just said when she sees Kelly's friends getting married and having kids and yeah. doing things, like, why couldn't she have had that? Why couldn't I have had that? Why couldn't I have been able to watch my daughter get to enjoy that? My kid's 18 forever.
Right.
You know, and it's just like, so I think of the way that Melissa thinks of it, and I think of the way that Connie thinks of it. And of course, they're coming from very different places, but everyone just wonders what Kelly would have done.
Right.
Because she just seemed like such a bright light.
Yeah.
But I don't think Melissa knew what was going to happen. And I think she was terrified she'd be next or her children would be.
Yeah.
It doesn't excuse it entirely, but I can understand. Melissa was also a victim of Dean's, and the victim count seems endless in this case. Melissa, their children, their families, Kelly, Kelly's family, the community, her friends and colleagues, the people who loved her and the people who didn't get the chance to. The family she didn't get to have. Her best years were ahead of her and they were stolen. In the show notes, you will see various resources for domestic violence and sexual assault. We have so many more resources linked in our resources highlight on our Instagram page. Please do your own research and know that it's okay and encouraged to ask for help.
Always.
But that is what I have for you today.
That's a hard one. That is heavy. And, you know, I like to sit in my little psych corner a lot of the time. But I think this is a really good example of people who deserve to work on healing. You know,
mm-hmm.
Connie, Melissa, Dean's kids. These are all really big, really open, really valid wounds that hurt a lot that none of them themselves made happen, you know?
And we're coming up on the 30-year anniversary.
Wow. It's a big one. And
I mean, in 2027, but to me, that's like, we're going to blink right and it's going to be here.
I know. Gross.
Makes me feel old.
It's so quick. But I think that it's important, especially when we look at these big anniversaries, especially as time passes. And, you know, from personal experience, I know what it's like to lose someone young and to wonder what they'd be doing when they got to my age, mm-hmm. or what they'd be at now, or who they'd love or who'd love them. And I think sometimes when it comes to that loss and when it comes to that grief, those wounds, I think the best thing we can do is really talk about them and process them and just figure out how to honor them in your own way. And it sounds like Connie's done a really phenomenal job of that.
I mean, the fact that Connie pushed for legislation and was a huge of why it passed, which I was surprised didn't already exist in Indiana.
Yeah, by 97, that's late.
Because when you look up Kelly's Law, there's like a million different things that show up. And then you look up Kelly's Law, Indiana, and it's like Kelly's Law Office at this street address. And I'm like, no, that's not what I mean. So I don't know what it's more formally called because I really couldn't find that. There isn't a ton of information available on this case, which is why I relied so heavily on those two episodes that I watched because I got a chance to hear it in those people's own words.
Right.
But it's not like they did these lengthy exclusive interviews that you would find with other more well-known cases maybe, or maybe even more recent cases, but just the fact that it wasn't possible for Connie, I mean, for both of Kelly's parents to be able to tell the monster who took their daughter away what he did, and that they just had to sit there silently and probably would have been scolded or escorted out if they erupted in any kind of emotion.
Right.
That I think families of victims are deserving in every case to be able to voice out loud to the accused, or to the convicted, that all of the ways in which they were hurt and what they took.
And I think in a lot of ways, that's a really big step for a lot of people in their healing. Mm-hmm. I think for quite a few offenders, that's a place where they start to realize the gravity and the impact of what they've done.
If they care at all.
If they're going to, that's usually a place to start. And I'm impressed that she was able to go through that. There's a lot of, for lack of a better word, sort of tediousness that comes with getting legislation passed mm-hmm. that can sometimes feel endless and draining and soul sucking when I'm sure she already feels hopeless and drained and soul sucked from everything that happened. So I give her a lot of props. I also think it's worth saying, and I wouldn't be me if I didn't, but if you know someone or you yourself are experiencing mental health symptoms such as paranoia or delusions, or you believe that things are more life or death than they may be, or you're having redouts and anger issues and you're taking that out on people, please tell someone who can help you, a professional who can help you.
988 is a great place to start, and you are going to see that in the show notes.
Hell yes. And also, you know what? You're never going to go somewhere and say, hey, help, I'm hearing this voice tell me to do a thing, or I believe that something is going to happen and so I need to hurt this person, or I just want to hurt someone.
Or I'm making my children hide upstairs and stay low to the ground with the lights off and the shades drawn.
Because I'm convinced.
Because I believe there's a threat to their safety and it hasn't come to fruition.
You're never going to say that to a trained therapist and get back a scoff or a laugh or get turned away. They're going to say, okay, we can work with this. Thank you for coming before something happened. And there's medication that help people with psychosis symptoms and paranoia. There's therapies. There are all sorts of things we can do to manage these things before we hurt other people.
The kinds of things we have available to us now that they didn't even have in the 90s, which incredible. To me feels like 10 years ago, but that's just the 90s kid in me. It's like, oh, it's, you know, it's still 2008.
Oh my gosh, seriously.
But to think of how far we've come, the average person doesn't know all of those things that exist, and you probably shouldn't. It really probably doesn't mean a whole lot to you usually. Right. But if you are struggling with those, I guarantee you there is something out there that can help you that you haven't heard of yet.
Yes.
So don't base it on, oh, well, they must not or they couldn't have, because help is available and you are deserving of it.
Right. And if you have these tumultuous interpersonal relationships, if you can't seem to find peace with the people that you love, if you are suffering because of what you think is normal, there's a chance it might not be normal. And that in and of itself is worth going and saying, hey, is this a me problem? Is this a them problem? Or is this an everybody problem?
Mm-hmm.
Because therapists and doctors can help with that kind of thing and say, hey, yeah, a lot of people bicker over loading the dishwasher. And they can say, hey, not a lot of people make their wife and kids hide upstairs, convinced somebody's going to come in and hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it doesn't happen.
I load the dishwasher like a feral raccoon, and my husband loads it like an architect.
Yep.
We are different breeds.
Yeah, there's a right way.
I drive him nuts.
I'm sure you do.
You know I do.
But all of that to say, you guys, no matter what side of this you're on, no matter what hurt you have, there's a way forward. There's a way to heal. There's a way to recover from that. And at least starting, you know, you're never going to get further back if you keep putting one foot in front of the next. So.
And, you know, we mean it when we say that we want this space to be unlike what I've experienced or I've heard. And I like to think I'm well-versed in a lot of podcasts that are out there, but to be able to talk about these things and learn from them, and Abby and I are going to grow and learn and change our minds and be educated or learn something new, and we want to share that with you. And so we want these things to be talked about. We want that to be on the table at all times, because we're not doing this to glorify any of it. We want to say, okay, what can we learn?
Right.
What can we analyze from this on both sides?
Yeah.
And how do we move forward? What was this for? Because it happened. So now what? In the wake of that, now what?
What do we get to take from this that in this giant, big, dark, stormy cloud we can find and call a silver lining? How do we keep it from happening again? How do we keep ourselves and our ATFDC fam from being on the victim side of things in whatever way we can think of? And how do we let people know if they have the potential of becoming an offender that there's a way out of that, and that's not something you have to do? But we are so grateful that you're here with us. We love having the dialogue with you guys, and we love our little corner of the internet.
We love our little corner of the true crime world keeps growing a lot. It's a little intimidating.
It is.
Thank you so much for every single one of you that's here. And if you started listening from the beginning,
thank you.
Apologies. We age like fine wine.
We sure do.
And I think.
I'm going to say we do, because I've heard some of those first ones and I say, ooh, that was a little rough.
Part of me wants to cover those cases again because they deserve a more polished
take.
Yeah, like where we know more of what we're doing with the mics. And yeah, we should be this distance from it. And we should. All of the weird filler things and all just the random shit that could be good. So who knows? Maybe we'll do that in like a Patreon or something.
Ooh, that'd be cool.
Redo them and make them sound nice. But we want to know what do you want to hear from us? What do you want in a Patreon?
Yeah.
What do you want in merch? We want to know all of that and more. Let us know. You can let us know via email. You can let us know on our Instagram page. You can let us know in Spotify.
Heck yeah.
Even if you listen on Spotify, but you do have an iPhone, I'm just saying, if you wanted to leave us an Apple review.
You totally could.
5 stars. I'm just saying. Totally biased.
You really could.
I think that would be really cool and like a cute little message. I would give you all the nose boops and we post them on our cute little Instagram.
Yes,
and
we love them.
Love it so much. So don't forget to do that and send us your pod pets.
So definitely send in those requests. Look through all of our links down in the link tree. That's where you can find our Instagram. You can find our email. If you go to our Instagram, of course, you'll see the people, the places, the things, but also all of the resources and the highlights that Allie does such a phenomenal job of putting up.
Oh, you're just blowing smoke.
I'm sure not. Our Instagram is a fun place to spend like an hour. You can see, again, not only who and what we're talking about, but there's funny little memes. There's resources for if you guys need them or a friend. And what I personally really love about our Instagram is we always try to highlight causes that are near and dear to our victims' families' hearts. And so you can go through all of those, see what people who have really struggled are championing for and what they want to put out into this world. So take a look, go through our link tree. You can see all of that. You can go to our Redbubble for some merch. You could donate to the pod if you wanted, but you have all week to do that. So if I look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodness gracious. Bye.